Side 7, The Boat of a Million Years by Powell Anderson, continuing on page 190. With its entrance towards sunrise, the lodge had at this time of day gone gloomy. Light from doorway and smoke hole lost itself in shadows brimming the circle of floor and walls. Things magical were blurs, gleams, hunched lumps. Deathless laid buffalo chips in the fire pit at the center. He worked with drill and tinder until flames licked small. After he had banked the fire, he put tobacco that traders bore from afar into his calumet, kindled it, breathed deep. Let the sacred dizziness whirl him off toward meditation. Insight escaped him. He was warmly glad when a form darkened the doorway. By then the sun was on the horizon he could not see. Light tinged with yellow the smoke that drifted thick and savory off cook fires. The din of celebration was at once loud and remote, only half real.
"Father," came a shy whisper.
"Enter,"
said Deathless.
"Be welcome."
Three geese stooped, passed through, settled on the opposite side of the pit. His face was barely visible, webbed and gullied with encroaching age, full of the concern that a Berdash need not be ashamed to show.
"I hoped you would give me refuge here, Father," he said.
"From what?" asked Deathless.
"Has anyone abused you?"
"No, no."
"Everybody is gleeful."
Three geese winced.
"That is what hurts. Even the old men seem to have cast their doubts from them."
"Save for you, and perhaps a few others."
"How should I know? More of the women are with us in their hearts, but the men sweep them along, and it is a mighty gain that Running Wolf and his followers have made. He promises unboundedly much in the future."
Three geese grunted an affirmative.
"Why do you not share these hopes?" Deathless asked. "You are my father, who was always kind to me," said the Berdash. "I fear there will be scant kindness in the morrow that Running Wolf brings."
"From what we know about the tribes who have gone the way of the horse, that is so."
"I have heard men say, when I happened to be in earshot of man talk, that some are forced to it."
"True.
They are thrust from their ancient homes, the eastern woodlands, out onto the prairie, by invaders from farther east. They say those invaders bear horrible weapons that shoot lightning. They get them from pale-skinned foreigners such as we hear rumors of, but others, like the Pariki, have freely taken to the horse and spill out of the west, out of the mountains yonder."
"They did not have to."
"We do not have to.
I have spoken with travelers, traders, whoever bears news from outside. North of us, the Arikara, Hidatsa, and Mandan still live in old and wise. They remain strong, well off, content. I would have us do the same.
I have talked with two or three of those young men who brought horses, despite your counsel, Father," said Three Geese. "One of them went forth with Running Wolf, first to practice, later on this buffalo hunt. They say, he says, they intend no disrespect, no overthrow of anything. They only want for us whatever is good in the new ways."
"I know.
I also know you cannot pick and choose. Change is a medicine bundle. You must refuse it altogether or take the whole thing." Sorrow thinned the voice of Three Geese. "Father, I do not question your wisdom, but I have heard some who do. They wonder if you can understand change. You who live outside of time."
Deathless smiled sadly through the dusk. "Strange, my son, strange that only now, when you near the end of your days, do we truly confide in each other."
He drew breath.
"Well, I seldom speak of my youth. It was so long ago that it seems a half-forgotten dream. But as a boy, I listened to my grandfather tell about the drought of many years that at last made our people trek eastward from the uplands to find a better home here. We were still learning how to be plains folk when I became a man. I had no idea then of what I was.
No, I expected to grow old and lie down to rest in the earth like everyone else. When slowly we came to see that this was not happening, what more soul-shaking change than that can you imagine? Since it was clear the gods had singled me out, I must seek the shaman, have him teach me, change from man to disciple, finally from house father to shaman myself. And the years flew by faster and faster. I saw girls born whom I wed when they were grown and buried when they had died, along with the children, the children. I saw more tribes pour onto the plains and war begin among them. Do you know it was only in your mother's girlhood that we decided we must build a stockade? True, a certain awe of me has helped keep enemies off, but Running Wolf has had a vision of new gods. He laughed wearily. Yes, my son, I have known change. I have felt time rush by like a river in flood, bearing the wreckage of hopes downstream out of sight. Now do you understand why I have tried to bulwark my people against it? They must heed you, Three Geese groaned. Make a medicine that will open their eyes and unstop their ears. Who can make a medicine against time? If anyone can, Father, that one is you. The Birdash hugged himself and shivered, though the air was still mild. This is a good life we have, a gentle life. Save it for us. I will try, said Deathless. Leave me alone with the spirits. He held out his arms, but first come and let me embrace you, my son. The old cold body trembled against the firm warm flesh. Then Three Geese said farewell and departed. Deathless sat unmoving as embers faded and night welled up out of the earth. Noise continued, drum throb, chants, feet stamping around an extravagant fire. It grew louder when the doorway brightened again. A full moon had risen. That gray went black as the moon climbed higher, though the ground outside remained hoar. At last the merrymaking dwindled until silence laid its robe over the whole village. No vision had come. Perhaps a dream would. He had heard that men of nomad tribes often tortured themselves in hope that that would call the spirits to them. He would abide with the ancient, unforced harmonies. On a few heaped skins, one atop him, he slept. Stars fared across heaven. Dew glittered in deepening chill. The very coyotes had quieted. Only the river murmured along the banks, under the cottonwoods, around the sandbars, on and on in retreat from the sinking moon. Slowly eastern stars dimmed as their part of the sky turned pale. The hoofs that neared scarcely broke the stillness. Riders dismounted, left their animals in care of chosen companions, approached on foot. They meant to steal the horses hobbled outside the stockade. A boy on watch saw them and sped for the gate. He screamed his warning till a warrior overtook him. A lance thrust cast him to hands and knees. Little Hair gobbled around the blood that welled into his mouth. He threshed about till he fell in a heap that looked very small. War cries ripped the dawn. Out! Roared Running Wolf before his house. It's an attack! Save the horses! He was the first to dash forth into the open, but men swarmed after him, mostly naked, clutching whatever weapons they had snatched. The strangers sprang at them. Alien words yowled, arrows whirred, men screamed when struck, less in pain than in fury. Running Wolf bore a tomahawk. He sought the thick of the foe and hewed, snarled, a tornado. Bewildered, the villagers nevertheless outnumbered the raiders. The Pariki leader yelled commands. His men rallied to him where he shook his lance on high. In a body, they beat the defenders aside and poured through the opened gate. Dawnlight strengthened. Like prairie dogs, women, children, old folk fled back into houses. The Pariki laughed and pursued them. Running Wolf lost time getting his dismayed fighters together. Meanwhile, the Pariki made their quick captures. A woman or child seized, hauled outside, or fine pelts grabbed, a buffalo robe, a shirt with colorful quillwork, and regathered in the lane that went straight to the gateway. One warrior found a beautiful young woman with an aging one and a crone in the smallest of the houses next to a round lodge. She wailed and clawed at his eyes. He pinned her wrists at her back and forced her along, regardless of struggles or of the others who sought to hinder him. A man bounded from the lodge. He was unarmed apart from a wand and a rattle. When he shook them, the warrior hooted and swung tomahawk at him. The man must dodge back. The raider and his prey joined the rest of the war band. Running Wolf's men milled in the entrance. At their backs, those Pariki who kept the horses arrived at a gallop with the free beasts on strings. The villagers scattered. The forayers seized manes, got on with a single leap, dragged booty or captives up after them. The men who had already been riding helped injured comrades mount and collected three or four dead. Running Wolf bayed, egged his people on. Their arrows were spent, but enough of them finally came at his heels that the foe made no further try for their herd. Instead, the Pariki rode west, bearing their prizes. Dazed with horror, the villagers did not give chase. The sun rose. Blood glowed brilliant. Deathless sought the battle place. Folk were getting busy there. Some mutilated two corpses the enemy had not recovered, so that the ghosts must forever drift in the dark. These persons wished aloud for live prisoners to torture to death. Others tended their own slain. Three Geese was among those who worked on the wounded. His hands eased anguish. His low voice helped men bite back any cries. Deathless joined him. The healing arts were part of a shaman's lore. "Father," said the Burdash, "I think we need you more to make medicine against fresh misfortune. I know not if any power to do that is left in me," Deathless replied. Three Geese pushed a shaft deeper into his shoulder until the barbed head came out the rear and he could pull the entire thing free. Blood welled, flies buzzed. He packed the hole with grass. "I am ashamed that I was not in the fight," he mumbled. "You are long past your youth, and fighting was never for you," Deathless said. "But I—well, this took me by surprise, and I have forgotten whatever I once knew about combat." Running Wolf stalked around, tallying the harm that had been done. He overheard. "None of us knew anything," he snapped. "We shall do better next time." Three Geese bit his lip. Deathless went impassive. Afterward he did undertake his duties as the shaman. With his disciple, who yesterday had never come near him, he led rites for the lost, cast spells for the clean mending of wounds, made offerings to the spirits. An elder mustered courage to ask why he did not seek omens. "The future has become too strange," he answered, and left the man standing appalled. By eventide he could take a short span to console Quailwing's children for the taking of their mother before he again went alone into the medicine lodge. Next morning the people buried the dead. Later they would dance in their honor. First, though, the hale men gathered at a place which had known happier meetings. Running Wolf had demanded it. No council of elders calmly finding their way toward agreement, but every man who could walk— and none cared to gainsay him. They assembled before a knoll near the bluff edge. Standing on it, a man could look south to the broad brown river and its trees, the only trees anywhere in sight. East to the stockade, the fields clustered about it, grave mounds both raw and time-worn. Elsewhere across grass that billowed and shimmered, green and white under a shrill wind, clouds flew past, trailing shadows through a sunlight gone harsh. Thunderheads loomed blue-black in the west. From here the works of man seemed no more than anthills, devoid of life. Nothing but the horses moved yonder. They chafed at their hobbles, eager to be off and away. Running Wolf mounted the knoll and raised an arm. "Hear me, my brothers," he called. Wrapped in a buffalo robe, he seemed even taller than he was. He had gashed his cheeks for mourning and painted black bars across his face for vengefulness. The wind fluttered the plumes in his headband. "We know what we have suffered," he told the eyes and the souls that sought him. Now we must think why it happened and how we shall keep it from ever happening again. I say to you, the answers are simple. We have few horses. We have hardly any men who are good hunters upon them, and we have no skilled warriors at all. We are poor and alone, huddled within our miserable walls, living off our meager crops. Meanwhile, other tribes ride forth to garner the wealth of the plains. Meat-fed, they grow strong. They can feed many mouths. Therefore, they breed many sons, who in turn become horsemen-hunters. They have the time and the mettle to learn war. Their tribes may be strewn widely, but proud brotherhoods and sisterhoods, oath societies, bind them together. Is it then any wonder that they make booty of us? His glance fell hard on Deathless, who stood in the front row under the hillock. The shaman's gaze responded, unwavering but blank. For years they stayed their hand, Running Wolf said. They knew we had one among us who was full of spirit power. Nonetheless, at last, a band of young men resolved to make a raid. I think some among them had had visions. Visions come readily to him who rides day after day across empty space and camps night after night beneath star-crowded skies. They may have urged each other on. I dare say they simply wanted our horses. The fight became as bloody as it did because we ourselves had no idea of how to wage it. This, too, we must learn. But what the Pariki have found, and soon every plains ranger will know, is that we have lost whatever defense was ours. What new medicine have we? He folded his arms. I ask you, Deathless Great One, what new medicine you can make, he said. Slowly he stepped aside. Indrawn breath whispered among the men, beneath the damp chill that streaked from the storm clouds. They stared at the shaman. He stood still an instant. Thereafter he climbed the knoll and confronted Running Wolf. He had not adorned himself in any way, merely donned buckskins. Against the other man he seemed drab, the life in him faded. Yet he spoke steadily. Let me ask you first, you who take leadership from your elders, let me ask you and let you tell us what you would have the people do. I did tell you, Running Wolf declared. We must get more horses. We can breed them, buy them, catch them wild, and, yes, steal them ourselves. We must go win our share of the riches on the plains. We must become skilled in the arts of war. We must find allies, enroll in societies, take our rightful place among folk who speak Lakotan tongues. And all this we must begin upon at once, else it will be too late. Thus is your beginning, said Deathless quietly. The end is that you will forsake your home and the graves of your ancestors. You will have no dwellings save your teepees, but be wanderers upon the earth like the buffalo, the coyote, and the wind. That may be, replied Running Wolf with the same levelness. What is bad about it? A gasp went from most listeners. But several young men nodded like horses tossing their heads. Show respect, quavered an aged grandson of the shaman. He is still the Deathless One. He is that, acknowledged Running Wolf. I have spoken what was in my heart. If it be mistaken, tell us. Then tell us what we should do, what we should become instead. He alone heard the answer. The rest divined it, and some wrestled with terror while others grew thoughtful, and yet others shivered as if in sight of prey. I cannot. Deathless turned from Running Wolf toward the gathering. His voice loudened, though each word fell stone-heavy. I have no further business here. I have no more medicine. Before any of you were born, rumors came to me of these new creatures, horses, and of strange men who had crossed great waters with lightnings at their command. In time the horses reached our country, and that which I feared began to happen. Today it is done. What will come of it nobody can foretell. All that I knew has crumbled between my fingers. whether you must change or not, and it may well be that you must, for you lack the numbers to keep a settlement defended, you will change, my people. You want it, enough of you, to draw the rest along. I no longer can. Time has overtaken me.
He raised his hand.
Therefore, with my blessing, let me go.
It was Running Wolf who cried, Go! Surely not! You have always been ours!
Deathless smiled the least bit. If I have learned anything in my lifetimes of years, he said, it is that there is no always. But where would you go? How?
My disciple can carry out what is needful until he wins stronger medicine from warrior tribes. My grown sons will see to the welfare of my two old wives and my small children. As for myself, I think I will fare alone in search of renewal, or else of death, and an end of striving.
Into their silence he finished. I served you as well as I was able. Now let me depart.
He walked down the knoll and away from them. Never did he look back.
Chapter 13. Follow the Drinking Gourd. A thunderstorm flamed and boomed during the night. By morning the sky was clear, everything a sparkle, but the fields were too wet for work. That didn't matter. Crops were coming along fine, alfalfa so deep a green you could nearly hear the color, and corn sure to be knee-high by the 4th of July. Matthew Edmonds decided that after chores and breakfast, he'd fix up his plow. The coulter needed sharpening, and there was a crack in the whipple tree. If he reinforced it, he could get yet another season's use out of it before Prudence called for replacement. Then Jane had a long list of tinkerings around the house for him. When he closed the kitchen door, he stopped and drew a breath on the top step. The air was cool and damp, rich with smells of soil, animals, growth. On his right, the sun had just cleared the woods behind the barn. The rooster weather vane there threw the light back aloft into a blue that had no end. The yard was muddy, but puddles shone like mirrors. He let his eyes run left, across silo, pigsty, chicken house, over his acres that rolled away beyond them, bearing the earth's abundance. Could any man ever make any real return for the blessings of the Lord? Something flickered at the edge of sight. He turned his head fully left. You could see the county road from here, about 100 yards off along the west edge of the property. On the other side lay Jesse Linden's land, but his house was to the north, hidden from this by its own patch of woods. The Edmonds drive was also screened from sight, lined with apple trees, whose fruit was starting to swell among pale bright leaves. Out from between them ran a woman. Chief, the half-collie, was helping 10-year-old Jacob take the cows to pasture. That was just as well. The woman acted scared when Frankie bounded forth barking at her, and he was only a fox terrier. At least she shied from him and made fending motions. She kept on running, though. No, she staggered, worn out, close to dropping. All she had on was a thin dress that had once been yellow, halfway down her shins. A shift, would the ladies call it? Ragged, filthy, and drenched. It clung to a skin from under which the flesh had melted away. That skin was the shade of weak coffee. Edmonds sprang down the steps and broke into a run himself. You Frankie, quiet, he hollered. Shut up! The little dog skipped aside, wagged his tail, and lolled his tongue. Man and woman met near the corn crib, stopped, stared at each other. She looked young, maybe 20, in spite of what hardship had done to her. Peter up and she'd be slender and tall instead of skinny. Her face was different from the usual, narrow, nose curved and not very wide, lips hardly fuller than on some whites, big eyes with beautiful long lashes. Hair cut short, wasn't really kinky. It would bush out if ever she let it grow. Edmonds thought with a pang how a slave owner must have forced her mother or her grandmother. The wind went raw in her throat. She tried to straighten, but a shiver took hold of her. Peace, Edmonds said. Thee is with friends. She stared. He was a big, sandy man, wearing clothes darker than most, and a hat that was flat of crown, broad of brim. After a moment she gasped,
"You Master Edmunds?"
He nodded. "Yes." His voice stayed easy. "And thee, I think, is a fugitive." She half lifted her hands.
"Please, sir, please, they's after me, right behind me."
"Then come."
He took her arm and led her across the yard to the kitchen door. The room beyond was large and sunny, clean scrubbed, but still full of sweet odors. Jane Edmunds was spooning oatmeal into Nellie, not quite one, while four-year-old William stood on a stool and manfully pumped water into a kettle fresh off the stove. Its earlier load steamed in a dishpan. Everybody stopped when Father and the negress appeared.
"This girl needs shelter, and quickly," Edmunds told his wife.
Herself fine-boned, hair peeping red from beneath a scarf, she dropped the spoon and clutched fist between fingers.
"Oh, dear, we haven't any real hiding place ready."
Decision. "Well, the attic must serve. Nothing in the basement to hide behind. Maybe the old trunk, if they search our house." The negress leaned against the counter. She didn't pant or shake now, but a wildness still dwelt in her eyes.
"Go with Jane," Edmunds told her. "Do what she says. We'll take care of thee."
A brown hand snaked out. The big butcher knife almost flew from the rack into its grasp.
"They ain't going to take me alive," she yelled.
"Put that down," Jane said, shocked.
"Child, child, thee must not be violent," Edmunds added. "Trust in the Lord."
The girl crouched back, blade bright in front of her.
"I don't want to hurt nobody," she answered, raspy-voiced. "But they find me. I kill myself before they take me back, and first I kill one of them, if in the Lord help me."
Tears stood forth in Jane's eyes. "What have they done to drive thee to this?" Edmunds cocked his head.
"Frankie's barking again. Don't wait. Let her keep the knife. Just get her out of sight. I'll go talk to them."
Since his boots were muddy, he went straight out and around the corner of the house to the front porch on the west side. The drive branched off, where the apple trees ended, an arm leading south. Edmunds hushed the dog and placed himself on the step before the screen door, arms folded. When the two men saw him, they cantered that way and drew rein. Their horses were splashed, but fairly fresh. At each saddle was sheathed a shotgun, at each belt hung a revolver. One rider was burly and blond, one gaunt and dark.
"Good day, friends,"
Edmunds greeted them.
"What can I do for ye?" "We're after a runaway nigger woman," said the blond man. "You seen her?"
"How does thee suppose I should know?" Edmunds replied. "Ohio is a free state. Any person of color passing by should be as free as thee or me." The dark man spat.
"How many like that you got around here? They're all runaways, and you damn well know it, Quaker."
"I do not, friend," said Edmunds with a smile. "Why, I could name thee George at the feed store, Caesar in the blacksmith shop, Mandy, who keeps house for the Abshires."
"Stop stalling us," snapped the blond man. "Listen, this morning early we seen her ourselves, way off. She ducked into some woods and shook us. But this here's just about the only way she could come, and we found barefoot tracks in the road."
"And up your drive," crowed his companion. Edmund shrugged. "It's getting to be summer. Children leave off their shoes whenever we let them." The blond man narrowed his eyes.
"All right, sir," he murmured. "If you're so innocent, you won't mind us looking through your place, will you?"
"She could have snuck in without you knowing," suggested the other.
He forced a smile. "You wouldn't like that, you with a wife and kids, I'll bet. We'll just make sure for you."
"Yeah, you wouldn't break the law," said the first. "You'll cooperate, sure. Come on, Alan."
He moved to dismount. Edmunds raised a thick, hard hand.
"Wait, friend," he called softly. "I am sorry, but I cannot invite either of you in."
"Huh?"
grunted the blond man.
Alan snickered.
"He's scared of what his wife'll do if we track up her floor, Gabe. Don't you worry, sir. We'll wipe our feet real good."
Edmund shook his head. It grieves me, friends, but neither of ye is welcome. Please go.
Then you are harboring the nigger,
Gabe exploded. I did not say that, friend. I simply do not wish to talk further with ye. Please get off my land.
Listen, you, helping a runaway. That's a federal crime. Could cost you $1,000 or 6 months in jail. Law says you got to help us.
An iniquitous ordinance, as wrong as President Pierce's designs on Cuba, plain contrary to God's commandments. Alan drew his pistol.
I'll give you a commandment, he snarled. Stand aside.
Edmonds didn't stir. The Constitution grants my family and me the right to be secure in our home, he told them with the same calm.
By God, the weapon lifted. You want to get shot?
That would be a pity. He would hang, you know. Gabe gestured.
Put that away, Alan.
He straightened in the saddle.
All right, Mr. Nigger Lover. Tain't far to town. I'm going right in there and get me a warrant and a deputy sheriff. Alan, you watch and see nobody sneaks out of here while I'm gone.
He squinted back at Edmonds.
Or you want to be reasonable? Your last chance, boy.
Unless the Lord show me otherwise, Edmonds said, I believe I am the reasonable man here, and ye, friends, are terribly mistaken.
All right, about time we started making some examples. Watch close, Alan.
Gabe wheeled his horse and struck spurs to flanks. In a shower of mud, he galloped away. Frankie's barking sounded thin against the hoofbeats.
Now, friend, kindly remove thyself, Edmund said to Alan.
The slave catcher grinned.
Oh, I think I'll just ride around this fine morning. Won't hurt nothing, won't poke in nowheres. Thee will, nevertheless, be trespassing. I don't think the judge'll call it that, you a lawbreaker and all. Friend, we in this family have always done our humble best to observe the law. Yeah, yeah.
Alan unlimbered his shotgun and laid it across his saddle bow. He clucked to the horse and jogged off around the yard on patrol. Edmonds went back inside. Jane was on hands and knees, cleaning tracks off her floors. She rose and stood quietly while her husband told her what had happened.
What shall we do? She asked.
I must think, he answered.
Surely the Lord will provide.
His gaze sought William.
My son, thee is happy, because thee is too young to know about evil.
However, thee can help us. Pray keep silent unless thee needs something for thyself, and then speak only to thy mother.
Say no word to anybody else till I tell thee.
Can thee do that?
Yes, father,
piped the boy, delighted by the responsibility. Edmonds chuckled. At thy age it won't be so easy. Later I'll tell thee a story about another boy named William. He became famous for keeping still. To this day they call him William the Silent. But thee'd better hold thyself aside. Thee may go play with thy toys. The lad pattered off. Jane wrung her hands.
Matthew, must we endanger the children?
Edmonds took both her hands in his.
A deal more dangerous it'd be to let wickedness go unresisted. Well, thee see to Nelly. I'd better catch Jacob on his way back, and we'll all have our work to do.
His older son, tanned and tow-headed, came into sight from behind the barn as the man stepped out again. Edmonds walked unhurriedly to meet him. Alan saw from a distance and rode toward them. The big dog, Chief, sensed trouble and growled. Edmonds quieted him.
Jacob, he said, go clean up.
Of course, father, replied the boy, surprised. But don't head for school. Wait in the house. I think I'll have an errand for thee. The blue eyes widened, went to the approaching stranger, back to the parent, kindled with understanding.
Yes, sir.
Jacob scampered from them. Alan halted.
What you been talking about?
He demanded. Can't a man speak to his son any more in these United States? The smallest bit of harshness touched Edmund's tone.
I almost wish my religion would let me kick thee off my grounds. Meanwhile, at least leave us alone in our business. It doesn't hurt anybody."
In spite of his weapons, Alan looked uneasy. Edmund stood bare powerful.
"I got my living to make, same as you," the slave catcher mumbled. "Plenty of honest jobs around. Where is thee from?" "Kentucky. Where else? Gabe Yancey and me, we been tracking that coon for days."
"Then the poor creature must be half dead from hunger and weariness. The Ohio's a wide river. Thee does not think she could swim across, does thee?"
"I don't know how, but them niggers got their ways. Somebody'd seen her yesterday on t'other bank, like she meant to cross. So we ferried over this morning, and sure enough found somebody else who'd spotted what had to be her. And then we seen her ourselves till she went into the woods. If only we'd have had a dog or two. Brave men chasing unarmed women like animals."
The rider leaned forward.
"Listen," he said, "she ain't just any old runaway off a plantation. There's something queer about her, something real wrong. That's how come Mr. Montgomery was fixin' to sell herself. He wants her back for more'n the money she's worth."
He wet his lips.
"And don't you forget, if she gets away, you got $1,000 owing to him, sides the fine in jail.
That's if they can prove I had anything to do with her escape." Anger flashed.
"You won't lie your way out of this."
"Lying is against the principles of the Society of Friends. Now kindly let me get on with my work."
"So you don't lie to nobody, huh? You ready to swear you ain't hiding any nigger?"
"Swearing is against our religion, too. We don't lie, that's all. It doesn't mean we have to make conversation." Edmunds turned his back and walked off. Alan didn't pursue him, but after a minute took up his rounds again. In the dimness of the wagon shed, Edmunds began to repair his plow. His mind wasn't really on it. At last he nodded to himself and returned to the house. Alan's look followed his every step. Inside he asked Jane,
"How's our guest?"
"I took some food up to her," she said. "Starved she is. This is the first station she's found."
"She struck off entirely on her own?"
"Well, naturally she'd heard about the Underground Railroad, but only that it exists. She lived on roots, grubs, a few times a meal in a slave cabin. Swam the river last night during the storm with a piece of driftwood to keep her afloat."
"If ever anybody earned freedom, she has.
How did she find us?" "Came on a Negro man and asked. From what she told me, I think it must have been Tommy Bradford."
Edmunds frowned. "I'd better speak to Tommy. He's a steady fellow, but we'll have to be more careful in future.
Well, we're pretty new in this traffic. Our first passenger."
"Too soon," she said fearfully. "We should have waited till thee had the hidey-hole dug and furnished.
This duty can't wait, dear."
"No, but what shall we do? Those dreadful anti-abolitionists in the neighborhood, they would be glad to see us ruined. Speak no evil of people. Jesse Linden is misguided, but he's not a bad man at heart. He'll come to the light eventually. Meanwhile, I have a notion."
Edmunds raised his voice. "Jacob!"
The boy entered the plainly, comfortably furnished parlor.
"Yes, father?"
Excitement danced in his tone, his whole being. Looming over him, Edmunds laid a hand on his shoulder.
"Listen carefully, son. I have an errand for thee. We have a guest today. For reasons that thee doesn't need to know, she's staying in the attic. Her dress isn't fit to be seen in. It was all she had, but we will provide her decent clothes. I want thee to take the foul old garment elsewhere and get rid of it."
"Can thee do that?"
Yes, sure, but—"
"I told thee to listen close. Thee may go barefoot, which I know thee enjoys, and carry a basket. Pick up some dead wood for kindling on the way home, eh? Keep the dress down in the basket. We don't want anybody offended. There is no hurry. Go across the road to the Linden's woods. Do not gather sticks there, of course. That would be stealing. Saunter about. Take pleasure in God's beautiful creation. When thee is by thyself, put on a black kerchief thy mother will give thee to cover thy hair from the sun.
It's pretty muddy. Thee would do well to roll up thy sleeves and trousers, and pull the dress over them. A smock to keep thine own clothes clean, understand? Just the same, I suppose thee'll get thy head and arms and legs mired up. Downright black, even. Well, I remember how I liked that when I was a kid. Edmunds laughed. Till I came back and my mother saw me. But this is a holiday for thee, so that such carelessness will be allowable. He paused. If perchance thee pass near the Linden house, so they spy thee, don't linger. Don't give them a good look, but run past quickly. They'd be scandalized to know young Jacob Edmunds was dressed and mucked like that. Dash back into the woods and bury the dress somewhere. Then circle back to our land and collect that kindling. Thee may take several hours, all told. He squeezed the shoulder and smiled. How's that sound, hm? His son had strained breathless at his words. Eagerness blazed. Yes, sir. Wonderful. I can do it. Jane touched her man's arm. Matthew, dear, he's only a child, she protested. Jacob reddened. Edmunds raised a palm. There should be no danger to him if he's as smart as I think he is. And thee, he said sternly to the face below his. Remember, Jesus doesn't like bragging. Tomorrow I'll give thee a note to the schoolmaster that I needed thy help here today. That's all that either of us has to tell anybody, ever. Got me? Jacob stood very straight. Yes, sir, I do. Good. I'd better get back to work. Have fun. Edmund stroked his wife's cheek softly and briefly before he went out. As he crossed the yard, Alan rode over and exclaimed, What you been doing? Minding my own business, Edmund said. We have a farm to run if thee has not heard. He went on into the shed and took up his task again. It was near midday, and he was growing hungry, Jacob doubtless wolfing the sandwiches Jane would have made, when the dogs barked and Alan whooped. Edmund strolled into the warm sunlight. Alongside Gabe rode a man with curly brown hair and troubled youthful face. The three of them brought their horses to meet the farmer. Good day, friend Peter, said Edmunds cheerily. Hi. Deputy Sheriff Frayne bit the greeting off. He struggled a few seconds before he could go on. Matt, I'm sorry, but this man's gone to Judge Abshire and got a search warrant for your place. That was not very neighborly of the judge, I must say. He's got to uphold the law, Matt. I do, too. Edmunds nodded. Everybody should, when it is at all possible. Well, they claim you're hiding a fugitive slave. That's a federal offense, Matt. I don't like it, but it's the law of the land. There is another law, Peter. Jesus Christ spoke it in Nazareth. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath set me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised. No more are your preaching, Quaker, Gabe shouted. He was tired, sweaty, on edge after so much faring to and fro. Deputy, do your duty. Search as thee will never find a slave on this land, Edmunds declared. Frayne stared. You swear to that? Thee knows I can't give an oath, Peter. Edmunds stood silent for a spell. Then, in a rush, But it'd bother my wife and frighten our little ones having ye ransack the house. So I'll confess. I did see a negro woman today.
You did?
Alan yelled. And didn't tell us right off? Why, you son of a bitch. That'll do, fellow. Frayne rapped. Any more and I'll run you in for abuse, threat, and menace. He turned to Edmunds. Can you describe what you saw? She was wearing a ragged yellow dress, badly stained, and it was clear she was traveling north. Before ye spend valuable time here, why not ask the people in that direction? Frayne scowled. Yeah, he said reluctantly. The Lindens are about a mile off, and they don't like abolitionists. They might have seen something, too, Edmunds reminded him. They wouldn't keep it from the tracks we followed, Alan began. Edmunds chopped air with his hand. Bah!
Barefoot tracks are everywhere. Look, if you find nothing, hear nothing, yonder, you can come back and search us. But I warn ye, it'll take hours, as many possible hiding places as a big farm has got, and meanwhile a fugitive who was not here would get clean away. Frayne stared hard at him. Gabe opened his mouth.
He's right, the deputy said. Let's go.
I don't know, Gabe muttered.
You want my help or not? I've been hauled from my business in town for this. I'm not about to lose another half a day watching you bumble around if it's needless.
You go ask, Gabe told Alan. My turn to guard this place.
I'll come along, Frayne said, and rode off with the warrant in his pocket.
Jane appeared on the kitchen steps.
Dinner, she hailed.
I regret we cannot invite thee to share our table, Edmund said to Gabe. A matter of principle. However, we'll send food out.
The slave catcher shook his head furiously and swatted at a fly.
To hell with you,
he grated, and trotted to a vantage point. Edmunds took his time washing up. He had barely finished saying grace when the dogs barked once more. Glancing out a window, he and Jane saw the deputy ride back into the yard and over to Gabe. After they had talked a minute, Gabe spurred his horse and disappeared between the apple trees. Soon he came back to sight on the road, northbound in a hurry. Edmunds went on to the steps.
"Will thee come eat with us, friend Peter?"
he called. The deputy rode to him.
"Thanks, but, I'd better get on back," he replied. "Another time. Or you folks come in to Molly and me, hey? Maybe next week?"
"I thank thee. We'll be in touch."
"Did the Lindens have news?"
"Yeah, Jesse told us how he glimpsed what's got to be her. We've seen the last of those two boys for a while, I guess."
Frayne hesitated.
"I never thought you'd give out information like that."
"I really didn't want my house invaded."
No, but still...
Frayne rubbed his chin.
"You said nobody'd ever find a slave on your land."
"I did."
"Then I suppose you haven't joined the railroad after all. There was some rumors."
"It's better not to listen to gossip."
"Yeah. And better not wonder too much."
Frayne laughed.
"I'm off. Give your missus my best."
He turned serious.
"If you did ever tell a lie, if you ever do, I'm sure it's in a rightful cause, Matt. I'm sure God will forgive you."
"Be as kind, but thus far falsehoods haven't been necessary. Not but what I don't have plenty of other sins to answer for. Good day, friend, and give thy Molly our love."
The deputy tipped his hat and departed. When he was out of earshot, Edmund stated,
"There are no slaves. It's against Christ's teaching that human beings should be property."
He went back in. Jane and William cast him expectant looks. Nellie gurgled. He smiled as widely as a mouth could stretch.
"They are gone," he said. "They took the bait. Let us give thanks to the Lord."
"Mr. Frayne?" asked his wife.
"He's gone home."
"Good. I mean, he'd be welcome, but now we can bring Flora down to eat with us."
"Oh, is that her name? Well, certainly. I should have thought of that myself."
Jane left the kitchen, set the ladder against a wall, climbed it, opened the trap door, murmured. In a short while she returned with Flora at her heels. The colored girl walked warily, eyes darting to and fro. A gown of the wife's rustled about her ankles. The knife quivered in her hand.
"Thee can surely put that from thee now," Edmunds told her. "We're safe."
"He really is."
Her gaze searched his. She laid the knife on the counter.
"Thee should never have taken it up, thee knows," Edmunds said.
A measure of strength had risen in the worn body. Pride rang.
"I wasn't going back there nohow. I'd die first. Hope I'd kill first." "Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord."
Edmund shook his head sadly.
"I dread his punishment of this sinful land when it comes."
He stepped forward and took the swart hands in his. "But let's not talk of such things.
On second thought, we should eat right away and give thanks later, when we can feel properly joyful.
But then, massa?
Why, Jane and I will see to it thee get a hot bath. Later thee'd better sleep. We can't risk keeping thee here. The hunters might be back tomorrow. As soon as it's dark, thee and I'll be off to the next station. Have no fears, Flora. Thee ought to reach Canada in another month or less.
You's mighty good, massa,
she breathed. Tears trembled on her lashes.
We try our best here to do what the Lord wants, as well as we can understand it. And by the way, I'm nobody's master. Now, for pity's sake, let's eat before the food gets cold.
Shyly, Flora took Jacob's chair.
I don't need much thank you, sir and ma'am. The lady done gimme something already.
Well, but we've a plenty of meat to get onto those bones of thine, answered Jane, and heaped her plate for her. Pork roast, mashed potatoes, gravy, squash, beans, pickles, cornbread, butter, jam, tumbler on the side full of milk that had sat in the cool of the spring house.
Edmunds kept up a drum fire of talk. Here's somebody who hasn't heard my jokes and stories a score of times, he said, and finally coaxed a few slight laughs from his guest. After pie and coffee, the grown-ups left William in charge of Nellie and retired to the parlor. Edmunds opened the family Bible and read aloud while they stood. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people, which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters. For I know their sorrows, and I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land, and unto a good land, and a large, unto a land overflowing with milk and honey.
Flora shivered. The tears ran free down her cheeks.
Let my people go, she whispered.
Jane hugged her and cried, too. When they had prayed together, Edmunds regarded the girl a while. She met his look, flinching no longer. A sunbeam through a window turned her darkly aglow. For the first time today he felt unsure of himself. He cleared his throat.
Flora, he said, thee needs rest before nightfall. But maybe thee would sleep better for having told us something about thyself.
Thee doesn't have to. It's just, well, here we are, if thee would like to talk to friends.
Tain't much to tell, sir, and some of it's too awful.
Do sit, Jane urged. Never mind me. My father is a doctor and I'm a farm wife. I don't flinch easy. They took chairs.
Did thee have far to go?
Edmunds asked. Flora nodded.
"'Deed I did, sir. Don't know how many miles, but I counted the days and nights. 17 of them. Often thought I was gonna die. Didn't mind that too much, long's they didn't catch me. They was gonna sell me down the river.'
Jane laid a hand over hers. "'They were? What on earth for? What were you doing there? I mean, your duties.'
"'Housemaid, ma'am. Nurse to Massa Montgomery's chillen.' Like I was to hisself when he little.
What? But 'twasn't too bad.
But they sell me. I knowed I'd be a field hand again or worse. Besides, I'd been thinking about freedom a long time. We hears things and passes them on to each other, us black folks.
Wait a minute, Edmunds broke in.
Did thee say thee was a mammy to thy master when he was a child? But thee can't be that old.
As Flora answered, he thought that already she bore herself like one free, and yes, proud. Maybe too proud.
Oh, I is, sir. That's why they was fixin' to sell me. Wasn't nothing I did wrong. But year by year, I saw how Massa and Missus was watchin' me more and more strange, same as everybody else. Then when she died, well, I knowed he couldn't stand havin' me there no more. Could yo' have...
Both the Edmundses sat silent.
"'Happened before,'
Flora went on after a minute, during which the grandfather clock had seemed to tick as loud as doom.
"'That's how come I knows what it's like being a field hand, not just watching and feeling sorry for them. No, I've been there. When that old master sold me to Massa Montgomery's father, he didn't say nothing about my age then, so I figured there was my chance.'
She stopped, swallowed, looked at the carpet.
Better not tell you how I got him to notice me and get me trained for the big house."
Edmunds felt his cheeks go fiery. Jane patted the hand beneath hers and murmured, "They needn't tell, dear. What choice has a slave ever had?"
"None, ma'am, and that's a fact. I was about 14 the first time I was sold, away from my father and mother, and that man and both his sons."
Laura's glance touched the Bible on its stand.
"Well, we suppose forgive, ain't we? Poor young Marse Brett, he done get killed in the war. I saw his pappy when the word come, and would have felt sorry for him, except I was too tired from work."
A chill went through Edmund's backbone.
"What war?"
"The revolution it was.
Yea, even us slaves heard about that.
But then the..."
"Flora."
"No, it can't be. That would make thee about 100 years old." Again she nodded.
"I buried my men, my real men, and I buried chillen when they wasn't sold off for me, and..."
Suddenly her firmness broke.
She reached out toward him. "It's been too long."
"Were you born in Africa?" Jane asked low. Flora fought for calmness.
"No, ma'am, in a slave cabin. But my dad, he was stolen away from there. He used to tell us young'uns about it, the tribe, the forest. And he was part Arab, and..."
She stiffened.
"He died. They all died, and never free, never free. I swore to myself I was gonna be, in their names I was. So I followed the drinking gourd, and here I is."
She buried her face in her hands and wept.
"We must be patient," Jane said across the bowed head.
"She's overwrought."
"Yes, what she's been through, I suppose that would drive anybody kind of crazy,"
Edmunds agreed. "Take her away, dear. Give her that bath. Put her to bed. Sit with her till she sleeps." "Of course." They went their separate ways. Though Jacob came home jubilantly, supper was quiet. His parents had decided to leave Flora resting as long as possible. Jane would pack a basket of food for the next stage of the journey. Once she said, "Matthew, I wonder what she meant by following the drinking gourd. Does thee know?"
"Yes, I've heard," he answered. "It's the Big Dipper, the one constellation nobody can mistake. They have a song about it, the slaves, I believe."
And he wondered what other songs went secretly through the land, and what songs might awaken in the future. Battle hymns?
No, please, God, have thy mercy. No, withhold thy wrath that we have so richly earned. Lead us to thy light.
As dusk fell, he and Jacob rode forth the buggy and harnessed Si to it.
"Can I come along, father?"
the boy asked.
"No," Edmund said. "I'll be gone till nearly sunrise. Thee has school tomorrow after chores."
He rumpled the bright head.
"Be patient. Man's work will come on thee quite soon enough."
After a moment,
"They made a fine start today. I can only hope the Lord won't later want far more."
Well, but heaven waited, the reward that has no bounds. Poor half-mad Flora! What if somebody really did have to live on and on like that, in bondage or hunted or whatever menial thing she could become in Canada? Edmund shuddered. God willing, as she met friendship along the Underground Railroad, she ought to recover her wits. A lantern glowed. Jane brought the fugitive out and helped her into the buggy. Edmunds mounted to the driver's seat.
"Good night, my dear,"
he said, and gently touched whip to horse. Wheels creaked down the drive and onto the road. The air was still fairly warm, though a touch of oncoming cold went through it. The sky ranged from purple in the west to velvety black in the east. Stars were blinking forth. The Big Dipper stood huge. Presently Edmunds made out the Little Dipper and Polaris in it, that guided north toward freedom. Chapter 14. Men of Peace. 1. The ranch house was small, a one-room sod cabin, but the more defensible for that. Its two windows had heavy inside shutters, and each wall a pair of loopholes. Picket stakes surrounded it, 6 deep,
Men built like this in the West Texas cattle country, such of them as weren't dead or fled.
"Lord, but I wish we'd cleared out in time," Tom Langford said. "You and the kids, at least."
"Hush now," replied his wife. "You couldn't run the spread without me, and if we gave up, we'd lose everything we've worked for." She leaned across the table, over the firearms and ammunition that covered it, to pat his arm. A sunbeam through a hole on the east side struck through the gloom within and made living bronze of her hair. "All we got to do is hold out till Bob brings help, unless the Redskins quit first." Langford kept himself from wondering whether the vaquero had gotten clean away. If the Comanches had spied him and sent pursuit with remounts, he must already lie scalped. No telling. Though you could see a long ways around here by day, the war band had appeared at dawn when folks were just getting started on the chores, and arrived faster than you might believe. Of the hands, only Ed Lee, Bill Davis, and Carlos Padilla had made it to the house with the family, and not before a bullet smashed Ed's left arm. Sissy had set and bandaged that limb as best she was able after the warriors recoiled from gunfire and withdrew out of sight. At the moment, Ed had Nancy Langford on his lap. The three-year-old clung hard to him, terrified. Bill kept watch at the north end, Carlos at the south, while Jim flitted between east and west in the pride and eagerness of his own 7 years. A sharpness of powder still hung in the air, and some smoke seemed to have drifted in from the barn as well. The Indians had torched it, the only wooden building on the place. The roar of its burning reached the defenders faintly, like a noise in a nightmare. "They're coming back!" Jim shrilled. Langford grabbed a Winchester off the table and sprang to the west wall. Behind him he heard Lee say, "Bill, you help the missus reload. Carlos, you be with Tom. Jim, you go round and tell me where I'm needed." The voice was ragged with pain, but the man could work a colt. Langford peered through his loophole. Sunlight brightened the bare ground outside. Dust puffed and swirled ruddy from the hoofs of oncoming mustangs. He got a brown body in his sights, but then the pony veered and the rider vanished, except for one leg. Indian trick, hang yourself down the other side. But a Comanche without a horse was only half himself. Langford's rifle cracked and nudged his shoulder. The mustang reared, screamed, went over, kicked. The warrior had thrown himself clear. He was lost in the dust and rampage. Langford realized he had pretty much wasted that shot and picked his next target with care. The bullets had to last. Riders would never take this house. They'd learned as much first time. They galloped around and around, whooping, firing. One toppled, another, another. "I didn't get them," Langford knew. "Carlos did. A real marksman, him. Brave, too. Could likely have gotten away from where he was when they showed up, but stuck with us. Well, I never did hold with looking down on a man just because he's Mexican." "Coming on foot over here," Jim cried. Yes, of course. The mounted braves provided covering fire, distraction, for those who snaked amongst the pickets. Langford allowed himself a glance backward. Bill Davis had left the table to join Ed Lee on the north. The black cowhand wasn't the best with a gun in these United States, but his targets were close, slowed down by the barrier, scornful of death. He blasted away. Susie brought him a reloaded rifle, took his emptied weapon back, fetched Ed a fresh pistol. The screams, hoofquake, shooting went on, world without end. You weren't scared, no time for that, but at the back of your head you wondered if there had ever been anything else, or ever would be. Suddenly it was over. The wild men gathered up their dead and wounded, and pulled off again. In the silence that followed, the clock sounded nearly as loud as a hammer nailing down a coffin lid. It was a big old grandfather clock, the single treasure from her parents' home that Susie had wanted carted out here. The dial glimmered through a blue haze. Langford's squinted eyes, which the powder smoke stung and whistled softly. Just about 10 minutes since the attack began. No more, dear God. Nancy had crawled into a corner. She huddled, hugging herself. Her mother went to give whatever comfort she could. 2. The wind across the high plains still bore much winter in it. This range wasn't as bleak as the Llano Estacado, over which the travelers had come.
But the spring rains had not started in earnest, and only a breath of green touched endless sere grass. Trees, willow or cottonwood, clumped by whatever streams ran through these miles, the occasional lonesome oak, reached bare limbs into a bleached sky. Game was plentiful, though. It wasn't buffalo, except for white bones, the work of white hunters. Buffalo were fast getting scarce. However, pronghorn, peccary, jackrabbit ran everywhere, with wolves and cougars to prey on them, while elk, bear, and cougar haunted the canyons. Jack Tarrant's party hadn't seen any cattle since well before they left New Mexico. Twice they passed abandoned ranches. The Red Terror woke to all its old fury while the states were at each other's throats, and the army had a lot of quelling yet to do, 7 years after Appomattox. Sunlight dazzled eastward vision. At first, Tarrant couldn't see what Francisco Herrera Carrillo pointed at. "Humo," the trader said, "no proviene de ningún campamento." He was a pale brown man with sharp features. Even on the trail he kept his chin shaven, mustache trimmed, clothes neat, as if to remind the world that among his forefathers were conquistadores. Tarrant looked a bit like him, given aquiline nose and large, slightly oblique eyes. After a moment he, too, made out the stain rising athwart heaven. "Not from a camp, when it's visible from below the horizon," he agreed slowly in the same Spanish. "What then? A grass fire?" "No, that would be wider spread. A building. I think we have found your Indians." Burly and red-bearded, Hook newly strapped on to stick out of his right sleeve, Rufus Bullen stumped over to join them. "Christ!" he growled. Two missing front teeth made his English slightly slurred. If others than Tarrant noticed the new growth that had begun to push stubs through the gums, they had said nothing about it.
"You mean they've set fire to a ranch?"
"What else?" Herrera replied coolly, holding to his own language. "I have not been in these parts for some time, but if I remember right and have my bearings, that is the Langford property. Or was. What are we waiting for? We can't let them—" Rufus broke off. His shoulders sagged. "Inutilis est," he mumbled. "We will probably arrive too late, and can certainly do nothing against a war band," Tarrant reminded him, also in Latin. Herrera shrugged. He had grown used to the Yankees dropping into that lingo. He recognized an occasional word from the mass, but no more, especially since they spoke it differently from the priests. This quest of theirs was mad anyway. "You wish to speak with the Comanches, no?" he observed. "You can hardly do that if you fight them. Come, let us eat and be on our way. If we're lucky, they will not have moved on before we get there." His sons Miguel and Pedro, young betrayal-wise, had wakened at dawn and gotten busy. A coffee pot steamed, and two pans sizzled on a grill above a fire of buffalo chips, an abundance of which remained, and mesquite. As hard as the seekers pushed, without time off to hunt, no bacon was left except fat for cooking, but they kept plenty of cornmeal to make tortillas, and 2 days ago the father had had the good luck to knock down a peccary. It had been quite a ways off. Every Comanchero was necessarily a crack shot. The travelers ate fast, cleaned camp gear, obeyed nature, left soap and razors till later, hit the saddle and set off. Herrera varied the pace between trot and canter, now and then a walk. The two whom he guided had learned to heed him. Easy though it seemed, this sparing of horseflesh covered many miles a day. Besides, the remuda amounted to just a pair of ponies each, and three pack mules. The sun climbed, the wind sank. Warmth crept into the air and drew sweet sweat odors from the mounts. Hoofs thudded, leather creaked. The tall, dry grass rustled aside. For a while the smoke rose higher, but presently it thinned, blew apart, faded away. Wings as black wheeled where it had been. "You can usually tell a Comanche camp from afar," Herrera remarked. "The vultures wait for the leavings." It was hard to tell whether Rufus flushed. Hats failed to keep skin like his from reddening and chapping. His voice did grate. "Dead bodies." That was in Spanish, which he could speak after a fashion.
"'Or bones and entrails,' Herrera replied. "'They have always been hunters, you know, when they are not at war.' A minute went by. "'Your buffalo killers destroy their livelihood.' "'Sometimes I think you like them,' Tarrant murmured. "'I have dealt with them since I was Pedro's age, as did my fathers before me,' Herrera said. "'One comes to a little understanding, whether one will or no.' Tarrant nodded. "'Comancheros had been trading out of Santa Fe for a century, "'since De Anza fought the tribes to a standstill "'and made a peace that endured, because he had gained their respect. "'It was a peace with the New Mexicans alone.' Spaniards elsewhere, any other Europeans, the Mexicans who ruled later, the Americans, Texan, Confederate, Yankee, who despoiled the Mexicans, those remained fair game. And indeed by now there had been such bloodshed and cruelty on both sides that truce between Comanches and Texans was no more thinkable than it was between Comanches and Apaches. Tarrant forced his mind back to his horse. He and Rufus had gotten fairly good at riding range style, but damn it, what they really were was seamen. Why couldn't their search have led them into the South Pacific or along the shores of Asia, or anywhere but this unbounded emptiness? Well, the search might be near an end, no matter how often he had thought it before. That coursed through his blood and shivered up his spine. Oh, Hiram, Psammetich, Pythias, Althea, Athenaeus, Aliot, Armand Cardinal Richelieu, Benjamin Franklin, how far has the river borne me from you? And all the lesser ones, beyond counting, down in dust, wholly forgotten save for whatever might glimmer in him, a comrade of decades or a drinking companion in a tavern, a wife and the children she bore him, or a woman chance met for a single night. Herrera's shout slammed him back into the day. Alto! And a rush of alien gutturals. Rufus dropped left hand to pistol. Tarrant gestured him from it. The boys brought the pack animals to a stop. Their eyes darted around. They were new to this and nervous. Despite his earlier times, between jaws ready to snap shut, Tarrant's flesh prickled. Two men had come around a brush-grown hillock where they must have been on watch. Their scruffy-looking mustangs closed the distance in a few pulse beats. They checked the gallop with invisible touch of knees and twitch of hackamore. Seated merely on blankets, they seemed parts of the beasts, centaurs. Their own frames were stocky, bandy-legged, swarthy, clad in breech-clouts, leggings, and moccasins. Midnight hair hung in twin braids past broad faces painted in the red and black of death. Leather sunshades had been left behind, and the war bonnet of the northern plains was unknown here. One man had stuck a few feathers into a headband. The other wore a great shaggy cap or helmet from which sprang buffalo horns. He carried a Henry repeating rifle. A bandolier of cartridges crossed his chest. His companion knocked an arrow to a short bow. Archers were rare of late, or so Tarrant had heard. Maybe this warrior was poor. Maybe he preferred the ancestral weapon. No matter. That barbed iron head could punch through ribs to the heart, and more shafts waited in their quiver. Herrera talked on. Buffalo horns grunted. The bowman slacked his string. Herrera turned in the saddle to regard his employers. "'The fight is not ended,' he told them, "'but the Cuerharana will receive us. "'Chief Quana himself is here.' Moisture glistened on his face. He had gone a bit pale around the nostrils. In English he added, for many Comanches knew some Spanish, "'Be very careful. Say of much anger. Say can easy kill a white man. 3. The ranch buildings had already been visible. As he drew closer, they seemed to Tarrant, if anything, more small and lonesome in the middle of immensity. He recognized what must be the owner's home, a bunkhouse, and three lesser outbuildings. Sod, they were little damaged. A barn with smoldering ashes and charred fragments. The family had doubtless spent a lot of money and hope on getting the lumber hauled to them. A couple of wagons had been pushed into the flames. A chicken coop had been emptied and smashed. Hoofs had trampled saplings that were to have grown into shelter against sun and wind. The Indians were camped where a windmill stood skeletal by the cattle trough for which it pumped water.
That put them out of rifle shot from the house and probably psyched through loopholes. About 30 teepees lifted their gaudily decorated buffalo hide cones across what had been a pasture. At a fire near the middle, women in buckskin gowns prepared captured, butchered steers for eating. They were rather few. The braves numbered maybe 100. They loafed about, napped, shot dice, cleaned firearms or whetted knives. Some sat grim in front of lodgings from within which sounded keening. They mourned kinsmen slain. A few, mounted, kept an eye on the many horses that grazed in the distance. They were as tough as their masters, those mustangs that could keep going on winter's grass. When the newcomers caught the notice of the camp, excitement kindled. Most people ran to crowd around and jabber. The stoic reserve of Indians was a myth unless they were in pain or dying. Then a warrior's pride was that not the most prolonged and agonizing torture his captors or their women could think of would make him cry aloud. It was an ill thing to fall into such hands. Buffalo Horn shouted and pushed his pony through the ruck. Herrera called greetings to men he knew. The smiles and waves that he got in return made Tarrant feel easier. If they took due care, his party ought to outlive this day. After all, to these folk, hospitality was sacred. Close by the windmill was a teepee whereon were painted signs that Herrera whispered were powerful. A man too dignified to leave it for curiosity's sake stood outside, arms folded. The travelers drew rein. Tarrant realized that he looked on Quanah, half-white war chief of the Quer-ha-rena. The name of that band meant antelopes, an American misnomer for the pronghorn, like buffalo for bison or corn for maize, and curious it seemed for the lords of the Staked Plains, the fiercest of all those Comanches whom the United States had yet to conquer. Save for lightning-like bands of yellow and ochre, he wore simply loincloth and moccasins, with a bowie knife sheathed on a belt. Yet there could be no mistaking him. From his mother's race he took straight nose and a height that towered, thickly muscled over his followers. However, he was even darker than most of them. His regard of the strangers was lion calm. Herrera greeted him deferentially in the tongue of the Nemernu, the people. Quanah nodded. Bienvenidos, he rumbled forth, and continued in accented but fluent Spanish. Dismount and come in. Tarrant felt relieved. In Santa Fe he had learned some of the Plains Indian sign language, but used it haltingly, and Herrera had told him that few Comanches were adept in it anyway. The trader had said Quanah might or might not condescend to speak Spanish with Americans. He had a certain grasp of English, too, though he would scarcely handicap himself with it when he didn't have to. "Muchas gracias, señor," Tarrant said, to establish that he was the head of this band. He wondered whether he should have used the honorific Don Quanah. Herrera left the remuda in charge of his sons and accompanied Tarrant and Rufus into the teepee behind the chief. Its outfit was sparse, little more than bedrolls. This was a war band. The light within fell gentle after the glare outside. The air smelled of leather and smoke. The men settled cross-legged in a circle. Two wives left, posting themselves at the entrance in case of a task for them. Quanah was not about to smoke any peace pipe, but Herrera had said it would be okay to offer cigarettes. Tarrant did while introducing himself and his friend. Deftly left-handed, Rufus took a matchbox from his pocket, extracted and struck a stick, lighted the tobacco. To have such a formidable-seeming man serve them honored both the principals. "We have come a weary way in the wish of finding you," Tarrant added. "We thought the antelopes would be on their home grounds, but you must ask anyone we met, and the earth itself, where you were gone." "Then you are not here to trade," said Quanah in Herrera's direction. "Señor Tarrant engaged me in Santa Fe to bring him to you, when he had learned I would be able to," the trader answered. "I did pack along some rifles and ammunition. One will be a gift to you. As for the rest, well, surely you have taken many cattle." Rufus sucked in a sharp breath. It was notorious that New Mexican ranchers wanted stock and would buy without questions.
Comancheros got small detachments of Indians to drive herds they had lifted out of Texas to that market in exchange for arms. Tarrant laid a hand on the redhead's knee and muttered in Latin against the outrage he saw.
"Stay quiet. You knew this."
"Make your camp with us," Quanah invited. "I expect we will be here until tomorrow morning." Hope quivered in Rufus' tone.
You will spare them in yonder house?"
Quanah scowled.
"No. They have cost us comrades. The enemy shall never boast that any defied us and lived."
He shrugged. "Besides, we have need of a short rest, as hard as we have fared, the better to fight the soldiers afterward." Yes, Tarrant understood. This was not really a plundering expedition. It was a campaign in a war. His inquiries had informed him of a Kiowa medicine man, Owl Prophet, who called for a great united thrust that would forever drive the white man from the plains. And last year, such horror erupted that Washington's attempts at peace came to an end. In fall, Ranald Mackenzie took the black troopers of his 4th Cavalry into these parts against the Antelopes. Quanah led a retreat that was a running fight, brilliantly waged. Mackenzie himself received an arrow wound, high up onto the Llano Estacado until winter forced the Americans to withdraw. Now he was returning. The stern gaze shifted to Tarrant.
"What do you want with us?"
"I too bear gifts, senor." Clothing, blankets, jewelry, liquor. Despite his remoteness from this conflict, Tarrant could not bring himself to convey weapons, nor would Rufus have stood for it. "My friend and I are from a distant land, California, by the western waters, which I'm sure you have heard of." In haste, because that territory belonged to the foe. "We have no quarrel with anyone here. The races are not foredoomed to blood feud," a risk that he deemed he should take. "Your mother was of our people. Before setting forth, I learned what I could about her. If you have any questions, I will try to answer them." Stillness fell. The hubbub outside seemed faint, distant. Herrera looked uneasy. Quanah sat expressionless, smoking. Time passed before the chief said heavily, "The Tejanos stole her, and my small sister from us. My father, Peta Nalconi, the war chief, mourned for her until at last he took a wound in battle that got inflamed and killed him. I have heard that she and the girl are dead." "Your sister died 8 years ago," Tarrant replied low. "Your mother soon followed her. She too was sick with grief and longing. Now they rest at peace, Quanah." The tale had been easy enough to obtain, a sensation remembered to this day. In 1836, an Indian band attacked Parker's Fort, a settlement in the Brazos Valley. They slew 5 men and mutilated them, as was Indian wont, preferably before death. They gang-raped Granny Parker after a lance pinned her to the ground. 2 of the several other women they violated were left with injuries almost as bad. 2 more women they carried away, together with 3 children. Among these was 9-year-old Cynthia Ann Parker. The women and boys were eventually ransomed back, though this was by no means the first time the Comanches took females for slaves. The tale of just what those 2 suffered came to stand for hundreds, and the Texas Rangers rode with vengeance in their hearts. Cynthia Ann fared better. Capriciously adopted, raised as a girl of the Nermerna, she forgot English, forgot well nigh everything of her early childhood, became an antelope and presently a mother. By all accounts, hers was a happy marriage. Peta Nalconi loved his wife and wanted no woman after he lost her. That was in 1860, when Sol Ross led a ranger expedition in retaliation for a raid and fell upon the Comanche camp. Its men were off hunting. The Texans shot what women and children fled too slowly, and a Mexican slave whom Ross believed to be the chief himself. Barely in time, a man saw through dirt and dung grease that the hair of one squaw was golden. The Parker clan and the state of Texas did everything they could for her. It was no use. She was Nadua, who only yearned back to the prairie and the people. Repeated attempts to escape finally forced her kinfolk to keep a guard on her. When disease robbed her of her daughter, she howled, tore and slashed her own flesh, sank into silence, and starved herself to death. Out on the plains, her younger son perished as wretchedly. Sickness dwelt always among the Indians. Tuberculosis, arthritis, worms, ophthalmia, the syphilis and smallpox that Europeans brought, a litany of ills without end. But her older son flourished, gathered a war band, became headman of the Antelopes. He refused to sign the Medicine Lodge treaty that would put the tribes on a reservation. Instead, he carried terror along the frontier. He was Quanah. "Have you seen their graves?" he asked levelly. "I have not," Terence said. "But if you wish, I can visit and tell them of your love." Quanah smoked for a while longer. At least he didn't outright call the white man a liar. Finally, "Why have you sought me?" Terence's pulse quickened. "It is not you, chief, great though your fame be. Word has come to me of somebody in your following. If I have heard aright, he hails from the north and has traveled widely and long. Yes, very long, longer than anybody knows, though he never seems to grow old. He must be a strange power. On your home grounds are Nermerna, who stayed behind, told us that he came along on this faring. My desire is to speak with him." "Why?" demanded Quanah. The bluntness, unlike an Indian, betokened tension below the iron surface. "I believe he will be glad to talk with me." Rufus puffed hard on his cigarette. Laid across his lap, the hook trembled. Quanah raised his voice to the squaws. One of them left. Quanah returned his look to Tarrant. "I have sent for Der Tsanoye, Peregrino," the Spanish for the Comanche name, wanderer. "Do you hope he will teach you his medicine?" he went on. "I have come to find out what it is." "I do not think he could tell you if he were willing, which I do not think he would be." Herrera peered at Tarrant. "You only told me you wanted to find out what might lie behind those rumors," the trader said. "It is dangerous to meddle in warriors' affairs." "Yes, I call myself a scientist," Tarrant snapped. To Quanah, "That is a man who seeks for whatever truth lies hidden behind things. How do the sun and the stars shine? How did the earth and life come to be? What really happened in the past?" "I know," replied the chief. "Thus you whites have found ways to do and make many terrible things, and the railroad runs where the buffalo grazed." Pause. "Well, I suppose Der Tsanoye can take care of himself." Starkly, "As for me, I must think how to capture yonder house." There was nothing more to say. End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.